This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Hugh Grant, is famous as an actor, but he's also known in England for his role in exposing how tabloids hacked the phones of celebrities and other people in the news. He also worked on the campaign to prevent England from leaving the European Union. He became famous for his romantic comedies, starting with his breakthrough role in the 1994 film Four Weddings and a Funeral, for which he won a Golden Globe. He also starred in Bridget Jones' Diary, About a Boy, Love Actually, Music and Lyrics, and Florence Foster Jenkins. In the miniseries A Very English Scandal, he played Jeremy Thorpe, the leader of the British Labour Party, who lost his power after a scandal involving his affair with a young man that led to blackmail and charges of conspiracy to murder. In Paddington 2, which starred an animated bear, Grant played the villain. Even some of his darker characters get on by charm and wit. The charm and wit erode pretty quickly in the HBO miniseries The Undoing, which just concluded. That's not a spoiler, but the next few minutes will have spoilers. So if that's a problem for you, tune back in about 9 minutes. We'll talk about many other things after that. When the first episode of The Undoing begins, Grant's character Jonathan and his wife, played by Nicole Kidman, are a privileged, attractive, wealthy couple. He's a pediatric oncologist. She's a psychotherapist who does couples counseling. They're sending their son to an expensive private school. After Elena, the mother of one of Jonathan's young patients, is murdered, Jonathan is charged with the crime. He was having an affair with her. We learn that he has a surprisingly dark side, but that doesn't necessarily mean he's a murderer. The case becomes a big media story, which is working against Jonathan. His lawyer suggests that he goes on TV to get people to see him as a flawed person, but not a killer. Here he is being interviewed on TV by Connie Chung, while his wife and son watch at home. Chung asks Jonathan what he wants people to see about him. Here's his response.
I suppose the answer to your question is the truth, which is to say that I'm flawed. I do not pass myself off as honorable because I'm not. I was unfaithful to a wife who I love. I hurt her, I hurt my son. Both those things are unforgivable.
You do admit that you're a cheater, but are you a killer? Did you kill Elena?
That I'm not guilty of.
Well, let's take your version of events. You say you suddenly came upon her, you discovered her dead. Well, why did you run?
Because I was in shock, and I mean that in the medical sense. So that's a cognitive shutdown. It's like a very extreme form of panic.
Innocent people do not flee.
Well, I didn't feel at all like an innocent man. I was guilty of infidelity, and I felt pretty certain that I was the cause of her death. Which is not to say that she died at my hands, but I felt it was possible, probable even, that someone else, in a fit of jealousy or rage. Let's not forget that. Sorry.
Go ahead. Let's not forget what?
That in all this, I lost someone I love.
Hugh Grant, welcome to Fresh Air. Thank you so much for coming.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me.
So you're so charming in the beginning of this series. Even when you're being condescending, like, you're charming, and you're an oncologist who saves children's lives. We have no reason to distrust you until you become the prime suspect in this murder. We're so used to you as an actor channeling, like, your charming side. You've been playing darker roles lately, including this one. Do you feel it's bringing out something different in you as an actor and that you have to draw on something different as an actor?
Yes. It's maybe my true self. I mean, it's alarming how many pretty unpleasant narcissists I've played or been offered in the last 6 or 7 years. I'm not sure what that says about me, but it's certainly been a blessed relief after having to be Mr. Nice Guy for so many years, which is a thankless task for any actor, and any actor will tell you that.
You know, we don't know until the final episode whether your character is really a sociopathic killer or not. And with each episode, you start to doubt him more. You start doubting his version of the truth more, but you don't really know. And I mean, the truth is usually in stories like this, the person who you think is guilty isn't. And then there's a surprise. Somebody else did it. Someone you didn't suspect. And there's a couple of opportunities where you think, oh, that's going to be the case. It's going to be this person who I didn't suspect. But your character really is the killer in this. So actors often like to do research. It's not like you were going to hang around with sociopathic murderers to see what's it like to be one. So what were you able to draw on to figure out the psychology of the character and the behavior?
Well, I'm pretty good on narcissists because there's plenty in my business. I've also spent a good deal of the last decade surprisingly close to politicians. They rival anyone I know in show business for narcissism. So I've seen a lot of that stuff up close. And then the bit I didn't know a lot about was doctors and at what point their marvelous abilities to cure can curdle them into something a little creepier, where the ego starts to take over. It's more about, I'm such a wonderful doctor, and I don't, you know, I'm not sure I really care if this person lives or dies, so long as I can test my new theory and then, you know, win another prize or get another chair of some teaching hospital or whatever. And so I researched that a bit. I talked to a lot of doctors in the UK and then in New York, and they were all much too nice. They were lovely people. And then finally I found one who wasn't an oncologist at all. He worked in another field, and well, my brother, who lives in Manhattan, and his wife had said, you need to meet this guy because he's so, he's the one that all the ladies want to go to for their knee operation, even when there's nothing wrong with their knee. So I went to see him, and he was very charming and well-dressed and likable. And I thought he was very useful to me. You could see some narcissism there as well.
So you had to convince yourself that a doctor who was a pediatrician and cares for children with cancer, he's an oncologist, and seems to be very good at what he does. You had to convince yourself that such a doctor could also be that dark and be capable of killing somebody.
Yes, yes, exactly. Well, I had to convince myself that there are cases of doctors where it's not about the patient, it's about them. And in the case of Jonathan, I think that everything was about him. Curing children was about him, and look how wonderful I am. His love for his wife and his child was about him. Look how much they adore me, and so on. And that's what's terrifying about him, really. But it was also enabled me to... The trick was, you know, actors have to... Your sort of number one duty is to be true to the character is. And, you know, I go to enormous lengths to try and do that diligently. I write enormously long backstories of my character. I work out in the tiniest detail motivations for every single thing they do or say in the film, in the story.
What was the backstory that you wrote for this character?
It's detailed and it's complex, and it was to do with being a sort of wonder kid growing up, brilliant at school, brilliant at games, loved by the girls, full of ego, full of himself, and just never managed to shake off that kind of self-adoration as some people do as they mature. In fact, it sort of deepened and got worse. And I invented this whole thing where he goes to Paris and he has an uncle that he really admires who's a doctor who is quite Machiavellian and sense of it's about science, it's not about the patients, and teaches him to read Nietzsche. I mean, you know, stuff like this that you never will pick up in the show, but somehow helps one to know one's character. There was a whole Parisian element to my look that I wanted to bring to the show. But in the end, Susanna Beer, who directed it, I think she thought it would look fishy, and it was all toned down.
Is there anything you had to unlearn from your rom-com roles as you started doing darker roles? Or on the other hand, it seems to me you were able to use some of your rom-com in The Undoing, which is a very dark role, because you could use some of that to cover up, you know, to have a kind of agreeable surface, charming surface, while other things were going on beneath the surface.
In episode one of The Undoing, I need the audience to think this man's lovely. And so I did use a bit of rom-com charm, I suppose, but in a very delicate way, I hope. And I also tried always to just keep something vaguely unsettling about him, even in episode one, like, is this guy too good to be true? So yeah, there's a bit of that. And as for changing my way of acting, that's just evolved. I've just learnt mistakes, and I've learnt, for me, it's all been about preparation, really, and everything's about thoughts. It's not about very often what I did before is I thought, I know how to say this line, particularly a funny line. I know how to get the laugh. And then I'd go there in front of the camera and I'd just try and replicate what I'd been doing in front of the mirror. That's disastrous. I'm now much better at not having any preconceived plan, and I just go in with the right thoughts and then just let it happen, because the camera loves anything freshly minted that moment. That's always the take that gets used. And it's also why I improvise quite a lot, because it's fresh. And what the camera hates is anything repeated or performed.
You also said you've hung out with a lot of politicians, and that's how you know a lot of them are narcissists. How did you get to hang out with a lot of politicians? I mean, you've played Jeremy Thorpe, the former leader of the Liberal Party. You've campaigned against Brexit. Are those ways that you've gotten to know politicians?
Yeah, although both of those are more recent. But way back, I think it was 2011, I don't know if you were aware of or watched any of the sort of phone hacking scandal blowing up in Britain. There were a number of us who'd been enraged for years about the extraordinary power of a few newspaper titles here, the power to really live above the law and to effectively run the country. They choose our prime ministers, and prime ministers don't legislate without checking first with a few wealthy newspaper barons. And we'd been ranting and raving about that for some years, but we realised the public was never going to get particularly fascinated in this subject unless there was something that scandalized them. And then there was, in 2011, one of the papers, it was revealed, had been hacking the phone of a teenage girl who'd been abducted and was subsequently murdered. And it's a complicated story, but the hacking of her phone gave the parents false hope, because when they were calling her phone, it looked like maybe she'd answered, and in fact, she'd already been murdered. And the public was revolted in a very big way. And on the back of that, we managed to get a big public inquiry, a judge-led inquiry. A huge thing happened in Britain with, you know, everyone from newspapers, everyone from the police, everyone from politics brought in, lasted a year. And recommendations were made to sort out the power of the press without curtailing their freedom. So then the campaign became about getting all that put into law. And it was very difficult because the Conservative government at that time was under massive pressure from these very powerful newspapers who were basically saying, if you put this into law, that's the end of you as prime minister, because they have that power. And in the end, it was made law, but they found a tiny loophole. And so it hasn't really come into effect yet.
And you were active in that because you were hacked. Your phone was hacked. And
yeah, so I was active because I'd always been furious about this abuse of power, and personally because, yes, I'd had my phone hacked. I had my apartment burgled by these newspapers. I mean, they really did live above the law. If something happened to you or one of your family and you called the police didn't turn up, but a journalist turned up, because that was the first call the police made, was to The Sun or the News of the World, because they were paid off by these papers. So it was like living under the Stasi. And having said that, the whole thing was never really about celebrities. I don't have masses of sympathy for celebrities, but there were lots of people who had nothing to do with show business who, for instance, had brothers killed serving in the British forces in Afghanistan, or they'd had their father killed in a terrorist explosion, or their son had been killed in a road accident. And they had their privacy grotesquely invaded with phone hacking or medical records being stolen, or journalists pretending to be something else, coming to the funeral, or, you know, it was all disgusting stuff. And that was part of what had me so angry for so many years. Yeah, and then I had this extraordinary moment where my car broke down in the middle of the countryside in south of England, and I didn't know what to do. I didn't know how to get to this golf game I was supposed to be at. And this car pulled up opposite, and I thought, great, this is some nice local person who's going to help me. And this guy got out with a long lens on his camera and started taking pictures of me. And by sheer ill luck, it happened to be an ex-features editor from the News of the World, which was at that time the, you know, dirtiest of the dirty British papers, who had recently retired and was now running a pub in that little corner of England. And he said, well, I'll give you a lift. And I said, well, I'd never get in your car. I was very rude to him. And then I realized I had no other way to go. So I got in the car with this monster. And all the way to the golf club, he was boasting about how everyone had been hacking my phone. And then all this amazing stuff about the special relationship between the Prime Minister, David Cameron, and the woman, Rebecca Wade, who was running the big newspapers, and how the police were all paid off. And I thought, God, I wish I could record this. And
and you did. I mean, you went to his pub, you brought a tape recorder, and you secretly recorded him. Is that legal?
Probably not. But anyway, I did it, and I published the transcript in a British magazine, and it created quite a stir. No one seemed to sue me for it, so I guess it was considered in the public interest.
What are some of the things you learned about how the tabloids invaded your privacy and the techniques that they used?
They would put a little GPS tracker on the bottom of your car. There was, you know, guys disguised as British telecom engineers putting a tap on your landline in your phone. And obviously, they were hacking the messages on my mobile phone like crazy. They got hold of my medical records on many occasions. And they burgled my flat, let's not forget that. I came home one day and found the front door had just been completely removed from its hinges, and they'd been through my flat in some detail. By the way, the people who were doing this were under orders. These were the foot soldiers, not the chiefs. And what annoys me is that in the sort of fallout from all this scandal, it was a lot of the foot soldiers who got arrested, who went to prison or got suspended sentences, and the chiefs are still there in power.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Hugh Grant. He stars in the HBO miniseries, The Undoing. One of my favorite rom-coms of the recent past is Music and Lyrics, in which you play a washed-up lead singer and songwriter from an 80s hair band, and you're kind of reduced to just playing your old songs and playing at fairs. You're not really a star anymore. And I just thought it captured... It's just a really fun film, and the music in it was so great and so funny because it was kind of like parodies of 80s songs, but they could have been real songs because they were actually pretty catchy. So I thought maybe we could play a song from Music and Lyrics. And this is the song that's basically a rock video that opens the movie. It's the opening credit sequence. And the song is Pop Goes My Heart. So you had to sing for it. Had you sung in public before?
No, but much harder for me was strutting around on stage, kind of dancing and, you know, performing with a mic in my hand. They gave me a brilliant choreographer who did all kind of Kylie Minogue and all those people, Britney Spears. And I think that was one of the low moments of my career, if not my life, was the first rehearsal with him. It was just him and a big boombox with some music in it in a vast rehearsal room somewhere in Manhattan. And he said, okay, well, before we try and work out any moves at all, he said, let me just see how you move naturally. So I'm going to put on some music and I just want you to freak out. He put on some music and, you know, I just stood still for 20 minutes. He was not getting that out of a 40-year-old Englishman
at 11 o'clock in the morning.
So it was very difficult. In the end, I did those scenes on a sneaky combination of whiskey and lorazepam tranquilizers brought to me by my loyal makeup girl in a 7-Up bottle.
Did you self-medicate for Love Actually, where you do a whole dance sequence solo?
No, I did that. I did that completely sober. I don't know how the hell that happened. But these are terrible things to have to do if you're an uptight Englishman.
Okay, so let's hear Pop Goes My Heart, and this is my guest Hugh Grant singing.
I never thought that I could be so satisfied. Every time that I look in your angel eyes, a shock inside me that words just can't describe.
How do you feel listening back to that?
Well, I'm very proud of it. I wish my children liked it more. I sometimes say, now listen to Daddy sing. And they say, oh, turn it off. But those words, which I love so much, you know, they're utter nonsense. And actually, were only meant to be temporary lyrics. And then they were going to write something better. And then we realized they were so bad, they were great.
Yes, you know, and for the chorus, Pop Goes My Heart, like he's in a hospital room with, like, doctors or surgeons and is having heart problems, because some rock videos were just like so surreal and so literal at the same time, like an alternating between the two. This was a perfect illustration of that.
And the acting was very often appalling, and so that was fun to do really shocking acting there.
Well, Hugh Grant, thank you so much for talking with us. It's been great to talk with you.
Well, it's been an honor to be on your show. Thanks very much.
Hugh Grant stars in the HBO limited series, The Undoing. The new movie drama, Ammonite, stars Kate Winslet and Saoirse Ronan as two women in the 1840s who forge an intense romantic bond. The movie was written and directed by Francis Lee. It opens this week in select theaters and will be released December 4th on several on-demand platforms. Our film critic, Justin Chang, has this review.
Back in 2017, the English writer and director Francis Lee made a wrenching drama called God's Own Country that I wish more people had seen. It told the story of two isolated young men on the rugged moors of North Yorkshire, tending a flock of sheep and falling passionately in love, sort of like a British Brokeback Mountain, only a lot more explicit and with a much happier ending. Now Lee has made another gorgeous windswept tale of forbidden love, this one set in the 1840s and centered on two women. It's called Ammonite, and it feels like a step up in scale and ambition, partly because it's about real-life figures, and partly because it stars Kate Winslet and Saoirse Ronan. But Lee's filmmaking is still as raw, intimate, and unhurried as it was in God's Own Country. He takes his time easing you into his character's world, which is important since that world is not an easy place to live. Winslet plays Mary Anning, a self-taught paleontologist who was known for her groundbreaking fossil discoveries along the shores and cliffs of Lyme Regis, a sleepy town in the English county of Dorset. The famous tongue twister, "She sells seashells by the seashore," is said to have been inspired by Anning, who sold many of her fossils, including those extinct mollusks known as ammonites. Mary is gruff and solitary, a kind of human hermit crab, who lives with her ailing mother, played by Gemma Jones. One day, an aspiring geologist named Roderick Murchison turns up, offering to pay Mary if she'll let him accompany her on one of her fossil hunts. She reluctantly agrees, as she and her mother could use the money. But Mary gets more than she bargained for. Roderick abruptly takes off and pays Mary to look after his young wife, Charlotte, for several weeks. Charlotte, played by Saoirse Ronan, is suffering from severe depression following a miscarriage. And while Mary finds her burdensome at first, she nurses the poor woman back to health. A spark soon ignites, and the two begin to enjoy each other's company. Charlotte helps Mary with her work, which both fascinates and energizes her. One night, the two attend a recital in the village, where Charlotte makes the mistake of sitting with another party, leaving Mary feeling slighted. But they reconcile later that night, and Charlotte reads Mary a few lines of poetry by firelight.
Is it that I am all alone? Yet in my dreams a form I view that thinks on me and loves me too. I start, and when the vision's flown, I weep and I am all alone. You're the most fascinating person there tonight. And I think the most beautiful.
In some ways, Ammonite suggests a companion piece to Portrait of a Lady on Fire, another 19th century lesbian love story set against a stark coastal landscape. Both films also make important points about the intellectual achievements of women, and the way so many of them have been ignored and even erased by men throughout history. In the movie, some of Mary's most remarkable finds are displayed in museums under a man's name, a nod to the fact that Anning herself was often denied credit for her work. Charlotte Murchison became a well-regarded geologist herself, and while she and Anning were close friends, it's unclear if they were really lovers. Ammonite is a free imagining of Mary's romantic life, and historical accuracy aside, it's gripping stuff. The erotic tension builds with such exquisite deliberation that when it finally erupts, the force of it practically shatters the screen. Ronan and Winslet give the sex scenes a startling physicality, which is fitting since the entire film is so intensely physical. Lee's camera shows us a way of life sustained by nonstop manual labor. He's particularly attentive to the roughness of Mary's hands, whether she's preparing food, digging up rocks on the beach, or sketching in her notebooks into the wee hours of the night. There are fine supporting performances from Alex Sicarianu as a charming village doctor, and from the great Fiona Shaw as a local apothecary who turns out to have some past romantic history with Mary. And Ronan is unsurprisingly good as Charlotte, whose love for Mary awakens in her a new sense of passion and purpose. But Ammonite really belongs to Winslet, who gives her richest performance in years. She makes Mary a profound study in alienation and loneliness, ill at ease with other people, and deeply protective of her secrets. In the end, it's telling that it's not neighborhood gossip or the stigma of homosexuality that threatens to keep these two women apart. It's Mary's need for control and her reluctance to let anyone into her carefully managed life. There's something heartbreaking about that, but something radically hopeful, too, as she and Charlotte circle the possibility of a future together. Ammonite may be set in the Victorian era, but it dares to envision a world in which women are ultimately free to make their own decisions, for themselves and for the ones they love.
Justin Chang is a film critic for the LA Times. He reviewed the new film Ammonite. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. Dave Davies has the next interview. I'll let him introduce it.
In 2017, many were shocked to read of a study that found that more than 1 in 3 people in a poor area of Alabama tested positive for traces of hookworm, an intestinal parasite long thought to have been eradicated in the United States. The findings were not a surprise to our guest, Catherine Coleman Flowers. She's an Alabama native who for years worked to bring attention to the problem of people living without sewage treatment so that human waste collects in their yards and sometimes backs up in plumbing pipes and seeps into their homes. Hookworm spreads when the larvae of the worms penetrate the skin of people walking or playing in soil contaminated with feces. As you'll soon hear, the hookworm study was a direct result of Coleman Flowers' activism. For 20 years, she's worked with advocacy organizations, philanthropists, business leaders, and elected officials on the issue of basic sanitation. She's testified before Congress and a United Nations panel in Geneva, And earlier this year, she was awarded a MacArthur Foundation Fellowship to continue her work. She's written a new memoir about her life and the battle for universal sanitation. It's called Waste: One Woman's Fight Against America's Dirty Secret. Catherine Coleman Flowers is the founder of the Center for Rural Enterprise and Environmental Justice, and since 2008 has been the Rural Development Manager at the Race and Poverty Initiative of the Equal Justice Initiative, founded by Brian Stevenson. She joins me from her home in Montgomery, Alabama. Catherine Coleman Flowers, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
You've been active on this issue for a long time and have brought a lot of people, philanthropists, reporters, elected officials, to rural areas to see for themselves poor people living with this problem of simply not having sanitary disposal of human waste. I'd like you to describe the experience of just one of these tours and the reaction of those who saw what you showed them.
Well, one of the persons whose reaction was, I think, sums it up was Dr. Philip Austin. Dr. Austin was the UN Special Rapporteur on Extreme Poverty. And when he was invited to Lowndes County as part of his official tour, he went to see areas where people were living amongst raw sewage. One of the homes that we went to, it was a compound with a number of mobile homes that set off of a dirt road. And one could see the water lines that carried water into the home going above what looked like a ditch full of raw sewage. And nearby was a basketball goal where children apparently played basketball. And when he saw it, there were reporters with us on his tour. And one of the reporters asked him, have you seen this before? And he said, this is uncommon in the developed world. And I thought that that spoke loudly of what I had felt for all of these years that I had seen this.
And so what people would see, and you'd taken so many people to this and observed their shock at what they saw, was often, you know, a piece of pipe, PCV pipe, running from a home or a trailer to, you know, a hole in the backyard. And then when you get closer, what do you see there?
When you get closer, you'll probably see human feces and toilet paper or whatever was flushed in the toilet that day. The one place that we went that stands out in my mind is that it was a pit full of raw sewage. As you said, the person had a PVC pipe, but there was a lot of ingenuity that's involved in this. The PVC pipe was buried underground, and it went to a pit. And in that pit, again, was full of, you know, raw sewage. And you could see the eyes of a frog that was embedded in the sewage and was peeping out from it. And oftentimes, depending on the time of the year, and now that the days we have longer, warmer seasons, there are mosquitoes sometimes congregated on top of the sewage.
Right. And those animals will spread this stuff to wherever they go.
Exactly.
You grew up in Lowndes County, Alabama. It's an interesting place in the history of the civil rights movement, isn't it?
Yes, it's a very interesting place in the history of the civil rights movement. Most people know about Lowndes because of its fight for voting rights and the establishment of the Lowndes County Freedom Organization, which was the original Black Panther Party. And that the Black Panther was chosen because a lot of the sharecroppers had not been afforded the opportunity to go to school. So they wanted to use a symbol that people could understand. And it also, you know, I think one of the slogans from that time was pull the tail for the Panther, when they organized their own political party and ran candidates on that party, because at that time it was not Black people running as candidates wasn't accepted on either the Republican or the Democratic Party. In Lowndes County. So that itself was a great accomplishment on the side of sharecroppers, former sharecroppers, who had been kicked off of property just because they sought the right to vote.
And that was the Lowndes County Freedom Party that preceded the Black Panther organization, right?
Yes.
And it's also, is this area on the route of the famous march from Selma to Montgomery that Dr. King led?
Yes, most of the Selma to Montgomery march route goes through Lowndes County. Lowndes County is actually between Selma and Montgomery.
You want to describe some of the rural poverty there? What distinguishes life there that brought you back there? You'd moved away and it had done lots of interesting things with your life, but I guess when you're in your middle age, you came back because you felt like the county needed help. Why did it need help?
Well, I had always been involved as an activist in Lowndes County, and even when I didn't live in a county, no matter where I was, I would always go back and always stay connected to things that were happening. So when I came home, I was very surprised at what I saw. A lot of people were living in mobile homes, and a lot of these mobile homes were in serious disrepair because they charged a lot of money for these homes, but the homes were very hard to maintain. And as it got warmer, you know, you can see the mold and mildew on the outside of the homes, and in some cases on the inside of the homes. We saw homes that were falling apart where people had to step over boards on the floor because the floors were weak. You know, the homes just were not sustainable. And a lot of people that are living in that type of poverty also have food insecurity. And because there are no grocery stores and no access to fresh food, there are lots of diabetes, so much diabetes, in fact, that there are, in some cases, the buses that provide, vans that provide transportation for people to go to dialysis two or three times a week. So it's that type of stark poverty, I believe. And some of these people are working, but they're working in jobs that are not paying a lot of money. They're not paying a living wage. And as a result, they're unable to have the type of access to health care and the other kinds of things to improve their quality of life.
When you first came back to Lowndes County, you were working in economic development in a job with the county. Your attention was drawn to this problem of a lack of sanitation. And I think I want to talk about just a little bit about why this happens. You know, I think most of our listeners have never thought about what happens when they flush the toilet, right? We flush it and it disappears because we're connected to a public, you know, sanitation and water system. What is it about these rural homes that make this problem particularly bad for them?
Well, first of all, there's no municipal system. Usually when people visit, or they, especially if they call me and they've never been to a rural community, they ask, well, why don't they connect to a municipal system? Well, out in a lot of rural communities and suburban communities around the United States, people are it's called on-site septic systems. And the on-site septic systems are something that the homeowner, at least in Alabama, the homeowner has to purchase and put it in place. Recently, we're working with a family who wanted or needed an on-site septic system, and we had the engineering done. You have to have a PERC test done in the state of Alabama. A PERC test is when they are checking the percolation rate, or the rate in which water drains through the soil. And that can determine whether or not, what type of system, septic system is needed in that location. Lowndes County has dense clay soils. It holds water, so it makes it harder. The other factor that we have found to be a problem is the water table. The water table is high, and the water table is getting higher because of sea level rise. A lot of people do not account for that when they are talking about on-site sanitation. And with that being a problem, this particular family that we were trying to help, they went down 25 inches and struck water. That's how high the water table was. I've been in situations where they've gone down 6 inches and struck water. So that means that there's a need for a different type of system. And the system designed for that property was designed in such a way that the owner owned it was a half acre of property. The system needed to treat wastewater from the home would have taken up close to 2/3 of the property, and it would have cost $28,000. And most families, not just poor families, but middle-class families in Lowndes County and other places in Alabama cannot afford that.
You know, you write about how when you got involved in this issue of a lack of sanitation, you met an environmentalist with the state health department who he went to a meeting and people got kind of angry at him. And so he wanted to connect with you. He invited you to his office to kind of see what the health department was doing to deal with this. Tell us about that. What did you learn from him?
Well, he and I had a lot in common, and that's why we were able to connect. And he showed me that, you know, what the permitting process was, how they maintained their records. It was all in a file, but he knew based on the number of permits that they had on file that most of the systems were not permitted. And while I was there, someone came to see him to ask him about a woman who lived in the community of Mosses and asked whether or not she had a permit for her septic system. And of course, when they looked and there was no permit there, he asked me would I ride with him. He took me over to her house and rode around the house, and we could see not only was there raw sewage on the ground, it was almost coming up the back of her wooden home. And her bathroom was pretty much sitting, that part of her house was sitting on the ground. So he took that time to also drive me around and show me other areas where he could tell just from the road that they had raw sewage on the ground because the grass was greener in that area.
Right. You develop an eye for it, right?
Yes.
You know, you mentioned that while you were in there with this health department official, that this guy had come in who was actually a builder, a contractor, right? And he wanted to know about this woman. Does she have a permit? Went over, discovered no, she didn't have a permit for a septic tank. And then you realized that there was probably a reason that this contractor was looking for this information. What was going on here?
Because she would be cited. And once she was cited, she was put in a position where she had to get it repaired.
And then he could do the work and make money from it.
He could do the work, yes.
It was astonishing to me to read that a lot of people that are in this situation, where if they are in a circumstance where the health department inspects and they do not have a permitted and effective septic system, that they can be noticed and eventually arrested for failing to provide this?
Well, what was happening in Lowndes County at the time, people were being cited, and this is one of the things that this environmentalist explained to me, that they were cited, and they said because the problem was so prevalent throughout the state, we were told that at that time that their stance was to only act if somebody reported it. So when it was reported to him, he would go see the situation, and then he would send them a citation, giving them so many days to get it corrected. And after they didn't get it corrected, within whatever that period of time was, they would go to court, and the judge could issue an order for them to correct it. And where they were being arrested was when they apparently violated the order.
You actually went to court a few times where people were facing arrest and explained to the judge, look, you're asking this family to do something it doesn't remotely have the resources to do, right?
Yes. I went to court at the invitation of the environmentalist. That's how I know they were in court that day.
The health department environmentalist, right?
Yes. The health department's environmentalist was concerned that a young man, would lose his job if he was arrested that day. If he was placed under arrest because he could not afford to put in his septic system. And apparently he had been trying to work with this young man, but it was just so expensive. And so when I went to court, I did explain it to the judge, and I explained to her that he couldn't afford it. I also explained that we were trying to help, you know, understand the problem and try to help families that were facing potentially being arrested for not having septic systems. So she eventually let him go. But there was also another person in the courtroom. And she had spent the weekend in jail and had been arrested for not having a septic system.
Well, you know, I mean, the county is obliged to insure you know, that there aren't dangerous and unhealthy conditions. That's why there's a permitting system. That's why they act. But it just doesn't make any sense to expect people to do what they cannot do, right?
It doesn't make any sense. I agree with you.
When you look at this problem of these individual poor homeowners, some in trailers, some of them in small homes that aren't connected to county systems, and septic systems are expensive, not particularly well suited to the clay soil and high water tables that you have there, is there a big fix? What would it take to really resolve this issue for people that are suffering?
What it's going to take is, first of all, use some technology that works. This problem is not just a Lowndes County problem. This is a problem all over rural America, and it's also a global problem. To give you an example, going outside of Lowndes County in the Miami-Dade County area, I saw an article that said that they had an over $1 billion septic tank problem because of sea level rise. They're not working. Now we're finding that the way wastewater is treated in some places create more contamination. In some cases, the leaks from wastewater is contaminating the drinking water. Leaks from wastewater is causing fish kills, algae blooms. And we have not understood that it's time for us to develop green wastewater treatment that takes into account climate change.
Well, Catherine Coleman Flowers, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you. Thank you.
Catherine Coleman Flowers spoke with Fresh Air's Dave Davies. She's the recipient of a 2020 MacArthur Fellowship. Her new book is called Waste: One Woman's Fight Against America's Dirty Secret.